to come at the moment. So the first time I came to PI was almost 5 years ago, like four and a half, 4 years, 8 months or something ago. And then I was also talking about forecasts for dark matter, and I was talking about forecasts for Euclid at the time, and Euclid's a space-based mission, so it's still like, you know, years and years off, and things are messy because it's a galaxy survey and all of that. But CMB Stage 4 is a ground-based instrument, and so it's going to happen much sooner. It'll probably start taking data about the same time as Euclid, so it gives you a difference in these timescales. So it's really nice to come full circle, and of course it's really nice to be back. So I'm going to tell you about testing dark matter with CMB Stage 4 experiments. This picture here is of the Atacama Cosmology Telescope, which is one of the telescopes that will be part of CMB Stage 4 if it gets built. The results I'm going to be telling you about half of them are from the CMB S4 science book, which has been sent to the Department of Energy in June to ask for funding for this experiment. And it will be on the archive sometime soonish, although I'm not in control of that, so who knows when. And the other half of the results are from this paper here, which has just been accepted in PID by myself and collaborators. So I'll begin with just cosmology and the CMB. So, you know, how do we all think of how do you do cosmology with the CMB? You have a map, you make a power spectrum, and you estimate some parameters. That's like the theorist's version of what happens. So you take a map like this of the CMB sky with the galaxy removed. You take some correlation functions and you Legendre transform them, and you get a power spectrum. And this is the Planck power spectrum, the 2013 one, I think. You know, lovely, loads of data points, theoretical curve going through it. So this is the Legendre transform, the two-point correlation function as a function of multipole moment or angle on the sky. You then need to be able to compute that theoretical curve that goes through it, for which you use some, you know, linear perturbation theory, some Boltzmann code, and then you do a Monte Carlo over the parameters of that, and you use Bayes' theorem, and you generate posterior distributions on those parameters. Easy peasy, and you get a bunch of parameters out. So these are, again, the Planck parameters. These are the six primary cosmological parameters, being the physical baryon density, physical cold dark matter density, the angular size of the sound horizon, that's the angular location of that first peak, tau, which is the optical depth of the reionization, which we'll discuss a little bit more at some point, and then the last two parameters are to do with the initial conditions, the slope and amplitude of the primordial fluctuations. All the other parameters underneath can be derived from these six primary parameters. So derived parameters are things like the age of the universe, the Hubble constant today, the amount of dark energy, the amplitude of fluctuations on 8 megaparsec scales, the redshift of reionization. Now, when we think of cosmology, in this picture, you know, with full sky maps and, you know, the advance of technology, the tendency is to think of the CMB as a satellite-based science or space-based science. And so we show pictures like this of the advance of cosmology over the last 20 years. We say, oh, COBE measured the fluctuations on 10 degree scales and we got the anisotropies. And then WMAP came along and measured the first acoustic peak. And wasn't that wonderful? And we started to get the standard cosmological model. And then Planck finishes it all off for us 10 years later. But actually, historically, really important advances in the CMB have been made by ground-based telescopes and balloon-borne telescopes. And of course, the first one is obviously the discovery of the CMB in 1965 by Penzias and Wilson. This was done from the ground. And so I'm going to show you a few slides now of like kind of the history of the CMB, which I've taken from Lyman Page's website, which is really good. If you want to know about the history of the CMB, you just go on Lyman Page's website. It's fantastic. Okay, so this is the status of the CMB for about 15 years. That plot that I showed you before, that lovely power spectrum, this is just delta T, but this is what we knew for about 14 years. And just, you know, this is not precision cosmology as we know it today. The next important thing that we learnt from the ground was the first acoustic peak, which was measured by Saskatoon, which was an experiment in Saskatchewan in around 1997. I mean, it's not quite perfectly, you know, it's not quite the acoustic peak as measured by WMAP, but it's certainly there. You know, there's a definite rise of power at about the 1 degree scale. And this is the thing that started to rule out models like cosmic strings as the origin for structure formation. That first acoustic peak's really important. That rise and then that first dip there, that SK3 point, that's really important. So again, very important thing in the history of the CMB, measured from the ground. And the last one that I want to give you in terms of the advance of the CMB coming from the ground is the detection of the lensing deflection power spectrum by the Atacama Cosmology Telescope in 2011 by Das et al. So this is the power spec, this is the kappa kappa CMB convergence power spectrum that ACT measures in 2011, and this was something like a I don't know 3 to 5 sigma detection of the lensing power. And that's really cool because as I'm going to show you later, lensing is a very important tool for testing dark matter using the CMB. So the CMB isn't all about satellites, and you can do an awful lot from the ground. And one of the reasons for that is that ground-based stuff can happen quicker. You don't have to build telescopes. I mean, you don't have to build satellites. It's quicker. It's faster. You can do more. You can spend more on your detector technology. You can upgrade more rapidly. You're not tied to these big satellite-based timescales. Pardon? Kappa is the convergence power.
What's that?
The convergence power. So if you have the lensing, you have the shear and the convergence. The shear is the off-diagonal terms, the kappa is the diagonal terms. It's related to the lensing potential power spectrum by some like factors of L and stuff. Okay, so what is CMB stage 4? So this is a rough sketch of what CMB stage 4 is. This comes from a Snowmass paper, and it's also in the CMB S4 science book. So it's kind of an approximate raw sensitivity as a function of year for CMB experiments, and it's got this kind of approximate Moore's law scaling. And where we are now are the solid curves. So this is CMB stage 2, are the blue ones. These are the ground-based experiments like ACT-POL, things that are kind of online at the moment. That's ACT is Atacama Cosmology Telescope, SPT is South Pole Telescope, and then there's BICEP and Polar Bear and things like that. Okay, yeah, I've got that here. South Pole Telescope, Atacama Cosmology Telescope, BICEP, which is at the South Pole, Polar Bear, which is in the Atacama. It's a possible upgrade of all these experiments together using the same technology so they can make maps all together, because at the moment we've got maps from different experiments, and, you know, it's not... We kind of combine them at the power spectrum level or the likelihood level in some way, but we're not making, you know, big maps with lots of different ground-based telescopes working together. PAMI S4 is to do that. And there may also possibly be some new telescope in the northern hemisphere, because all these are in the southern hemisphere, so you can't view all of the sky that's uncontaminated by the galaxy. Okay, so stage 2 is where we're at the moment. Stage 3 is kind of intermediate experiments, and that they're upgrades that are happening. So it would be something like SPT3G or Advanced ACT-POL, things that are currently happening, but they haven't taken maps yet. And then S4 is the next upgrade again. And so you see here, they're factors of 10 in the numbers of detectors on the sky. And so S4 is about an order of magnitude in sensitivity higher than what we've got at the moment. At a glance, this is what CMB stage 4 will do. It will, if it's funded, it will begin taking data in about 2020. And it will run for about 4 years. We'll get the temperature, polarization, and lensing spectra out to multipoles of about 4,000, which you can compare to maximum multipoles of about 2,000 in Planck, say. And in Planck, in the lensing, we only go out to a few hundred even. The kind of straw man version of CMB stage 4, I mean, we look at survey optimization, although I'd forgot to put those plots in, but I can show you them later if you want. Fiducial is 1 microkelvin arc minute noise and 1 arc minute beam, and covering a fraction of the sky of about 0.4. And then just for comparison again, here are the sizes of the beams for WMAP and Planck. We have 8 frequency bands on the sky. That's important for things like foreground removal, which I'm not gonna discuss. But you might remember that one of the big things with BICEP 2 and whether or not they detected, you know, large angle primary B modes was that you have to be able to characterize the spectrum in terms of frequency, not just in terms of multipole of what you're seeing, in order to determine whether it's primary CMB, which is a black body, or something like dust or synchrotron, which is a power law. The cameras that are proposed to use are just existing technology, but scaled up to more and more detectors on the sky. The aim is to be able to have an uncertainty on the tensor to scalar ratio of about 0.1%, which, again, for comparison, the BICEP upper limit, after taking account of dust, are less than about 10%. There's big improvements on the tensor to scalar ratio, although I don't care about that, and some of the science goals are a little bit in opposition for that versus measuring neutrinos. Dark energy figure of merit, which I hate as a way of characterizing how good dark energy experiments are, but I'll use it anyway, will go up by about a factor of 2 by the cluster measurements that you'll get from S4. And then at the end, these are the ones that I'm interested in. Neutrino mass, you can get an uncertainty on the neutrino mass. Some of the neutrino masses are about 15 milli electron volts, which if you compare to the minimum sum of neutrino masses in the normal hierarchy, given what we know from neutrino mass splittings, the minimum possible mass is about 60 milli electron volts. So we're really aiming at a multi-sigma detection of neutrino mass using the CMB, which I'll talk about. We're talking about an error on the number of relativistic species of about 2%, which is a factor of about 10 improvements over Planck. This is very interesting and important for reasons that I'll discuss. And close to my heart is an improvement on the fraction of dark matter that could be in a very light particle like an axion will again improve on that on the constraints on that fraction by a factor of about 10 compared to Planck. More details of all of this are in the this paper by Abazajian et al. And in the science book, which will appear soon. So I'm going to focus on neutrino masses, relativistic species, and axions. So before I tell you what S4 can do, I'm going to go into a little bit more detail about what we know about those things from current measurements. So we'll start with neutrino mass and what we know from Planck. So these are just figures from the Planck cosmological parameters paper. So we know from neutrino oscillation experiments that measure the mass splittings of neutrinos, but not the overall scale. Different assumptions about the hierarchy then tell you what the different possible total mass could be, given that you know the splittings. And in the minimal assumption of the normal hierarchy, the minimum mass is greater than about 0.06 eV. In cosmology, we see this sum of neutrino masses in kind of two distinct ways. We see it in terms of the background expansion, in terms of the energy density in neutrinos. There might be a H squared there, not just an omega nu, I can't remember. So it's just the sum of the neutrino masses over 93.14 gives you the energy density. That's just from thermal freeze out. And so that will have effects on the background expansion. You know, you have something that appears like radiation in the early universe, matter in the late universe. That's how you get a rough bound on the neutrino masses, is from that location of the first acoustic peak, the timescale of matter radiation equality. If the neutrinos are behaving like matter during the radiation era, they're heavy enough such that their mass is larger than the temperature at matter radiation equality, then you'll change things like the sound horizon. But a lot of the constraints that we get from neutrinos and we're going to continue to get from the lensing come from something called free streaming. So neutrinos are hot dark matter, they're relativistic when they decouple, which means that there is a scale over which they have moved at their speed of light during the expansion of the universe. And on that scale, on that free streaming scale, they can't cluster. Whereas cold dark matter is cold at all times, it has no free streaming scale, and it decoupled while it was non-relativistic. And so cold dark matter couples on all clusters on all scales. Hot dark matter doesn't cluster below the free streaming scale. And that also leads to constraints. The 95% limits from Planck on the sum of the masses are, you know, of order the kind of 0.1 to 0.5 eV level, depending on whether you use Planck and lensing or whether you include an external H0 prior. And the external H0 prior, what that does for you is that fixes the matter density, basically. And the matter density kind of gives you the overall amplitude of the lensing spectrum. Once you've fixed the scalar amplitude with temperature, tau, and the optical depth from large-scale polarization, the thing that then controls the amplitude of the matter fluctuations is omega matter. You can nail that with H naught, and then you can start to see the effect of free streaming. That's a scale dependent amplitude. And then, so these are the, this is the posterior distribution on the neutrino mass under all these different assumptions of data combinations from Planck. And you see the constraints are about 0.2 eV. Planck also constrains the effective number of relativistic degrees of freedom. We parameterize this in cosmology in this way. So the radiation density is the effective number of relativistic species times this factor, because neutrinos are fermions, and times the photon density. And this additional radiation also changes the expansion rate. And the way we see that in the CMB is, so you change the expansion rate, you change the location of the first acoustic peak. You can compensate for that by changing H naught and bring it back, but you still see an additional effect of suppression of the high L acoustic peaks caused by this ineffective, because you're changing the diffusion distance. So by changing the expansion rate during the radiation era, you change the diffusion distance, and that changes the amount of silk damping. So ineffective is constrained by the CMB at first order just by its effect on the expansion rate. So it doesn't care whether you're a fermion or a boson or whatever you are, you're just relativistic. You just scale it 1/8. And that gives you this constraint at 68% confidence levels. Ineffective is 3.04. It's a coincidence that it lands right in the center of 3.04 is what we expect for ordinary neutrinos. It's not quite 3 because they're heated after electron-positron annihilation. The photons are heated relative to them by electron-positron annihilation. So 3.04 plus or minus about 0.2. It's interesting to think, well, what does that actually tell us about the number of relativistic degrees of freedom at different temperatures during the evolution of the universe? And so this is a plot from the CMBS4 science book, and it sets as a natural target for future, because you can say, well, I could just constrain an effective arbitrarily close to 3.04, but what does that tell me? It tells you about whether or not a single particle, in addition to the standard model, decoupled at a certain temperature, throws out at a certain temperature. So because the number of relativistic degrees of freedom of the standard model becomes constant above the top mass, the top's the heaviest particle in the standard model, the number of relativistic degrees of freedom changes as the temperature drops below the mass of different particles, with a big jump at the QCD phase transition when confinement happens. Anything that throws out above the top mass contributes a constant amount to delta ineffective, and it's then diluted down from the one that it was there, or what, you know, 3/4 or however it is you count it for fermions versus scalars and vectors. It's then diluted down to 0.027 for a real scalar, 0.047 for a vial fermion, or 0.054 for a vector. So Planck, if you think about it, that 0.2-ish constraint from Planck at 1 or 2 sigma, is really saying that any of these particles, scalars, fermions, or vectors, had to have decoupled before the QCD phase transition. That's a froze out before QCD. That's an interesting thing. But because we know that the standard model degrees of freedom become constant above the top mass, hitting these targets for delta N effective will start to tell us about physics beyond the standard model. So this is important. Another thing we learn about neutrinos from current data is that, are they really neutrinos? So for a neutrino, this effective sound speed and the viscous sound speed are fixed to be 1/3, whereas for something else that behaves like radiation in the background, say a scalar field coherently oscillating in a lambda phi to the 4th potential, has the effective sound speed of 1 and viscous sound speed of 0. So you can actually tell that it's a neutrino and not lambda phi to the 4th field coherently oscillating by trying to measure these parameters. And they are consistent, measured by Planck, with the values 1/3. And this comes from kind of phase shifts of the acoustic peaks. There's a nice paper by Lloyd Knox about it. Yes?
Can you just remind me how the two sound speeds are defined?
I cannot. Sorry. There's a section on it in the Planck cosmology paper. They're coefficients in the first order equations of motion for delta dot and theta dot. I can't remember exactly how they're defined though, sorry. But it's consistent with the neutrinos that we see, those three, actually being neutrinos and not like, you know, neutrinos don't actually exist in cosmology and it's some lambda phi to the fourth field oscillating with the same energy density. It's not, because we've measured these parameters.
So does it have, and is it like anisotropic stress behaves differently for the scalar field than it does for the
viscous? Yes, I think that's what the viscous sound speed tells you, yeah. And the effective sound speed, I think the effective sound speed is the one that for a scalar field is, you know, delta P over delta rho, that sound speed calculating the rest frame. I know that's what the effective sound speed is. I don't know what the viscous sound speed is though. And we can also look for sterile neutrinos. If you allow for a sterile neutrino, you just get an upper bound on an effective, upper bound on the mass of that sterile neutrino. We can combine keeping three active neutrinos with a total mass plus some additional dark radiation, then we get slightly different constraints than an effective and the sum of neutrino masses. We also see quite nicely that the number of effective relativistic degrees of freedom, if we allow that to vary as well as the helium fraction at BBN, the contours of the constraints in the CMB, and they are consistent with the measured values of the helium abundance and the prediction from standard BBN of how the helium abundance depends on an effective. So it's all kind of consistent with standard BBN, which is very nice. The final thing on my laundry list that we learned from Planck already is, many of you have seen talks about me before. This is my favorite plot because I did it. So we have a constraint on a possible axion component of dark matter. So if you have ultralight axions, which are cold, produced by vacuum realignment, it's an m squared phi squared field oscillating in its potential. You can look at its effect in the background expansion and the perturbations, just like we can for the neutrinos. You change the background expansion and the clustering on scales where the horizon size 1 over h is less than m on some scale of interest. So like, you know, mass radiation equality is h is 10 to the minus 28 eV. So if your mass is less than 10 to the minus 28 eV, you affect the expansion rate and the clustering on scales and on time scales and length scales larger than mass radiation equality, for example. And so we can constrain the fraction of dark matter in such a species as a function of its mass. And over about 7 to 8 orders of magnitude in mass, we get percent level, 10%, 5 to 10% level constraints on the amount of dark matter that could be allowed in such a species. Something we'll come back, these contours are 2 to 3 sigma. Something we'll come back to is, in the context of axions, and I'll reiterate it in the plot later on, this corresponds to what you would expect an axion to contribute if its decay constant was about 10 to the 17 GeV or above. So if any of these axions here had decay constants above 10 to the 17 GeV, they would violate these constraints. But I'll talk about how you can push that later. Not this population. So that there are different ways you can produce axions. You can produce them thermally, which I'll talk about in a couple of slides' time. But in this non-thermal production, they don't affect the number of relativistic degrees of freedom. It's just this vacuum realignment population. And this is a kind of model-independent production, whereas the thermal production that gives you relativistic degrees of freedom depends on your couplings to the standard model. This is independent of your couplings. It does depend on your initial conditions, which is why it depends on FA. So, I've given you the lowdown on dark matter constraints, the ones that I'm interested in from the CMB at the moment, dark sector constraints, and now let's go into what we can do with CMB S4. So the results I'm going to show you again are from the science book. They're from Allison et al. 2015 and Logic et al. 2016. I was on this paper, the one at the end, and also chapters in the science book. So I'm going to talk about constraints very, very quickly to tell you about how we do them. We use Fisher matrix forecasts. There's a nice intro to this by Bassett et al. There are a number of other ones. So the Fisher matrix is, well, you approximate the covariance matrix by the inverse of this guy, which is the derivative of the likelihood function with respect to your parameters. And the second derivative of the likelihood function with respect to your parameters, which we do, we take numerical derivatives, so your likelihood will be like, you know, you've got your CL, you've got like, you've got your project, your error bars, and then you compute the likelihood from that, and then you take the derivatives numerically. It assumes that the covariance is a Gaussian. So this is good for the type of forecast that we want to do for temperature, e-polarization, and convergence, but it is not good for B-modes. So all the forecasts that I'm going to show you do not include the effect of B-modes because they don't have Gaussian covariances. You can do B-modes from like map-based things and stuff like that. There's a lot of discussion, of course, about how to do B-mode forecasts in the S4 Science book.
Are you referring to Lansing induced Gaussian
in the B-modes?
Yeah.
Certainly that, yeah. And I think that's what would be relevant for us, not for large angle Bs. Because I'm not including tenses, so I think just the Lansing induced B modes then. So you've got a model for how to get your covariance. You need a model for the noise from your experiments, which is the errors. So you take a white noise power spectrum, and I'm not going to talk about the effects of foreground cleaning. I'm just going to assume that the foregrounds have been cleaned up to some particular L max, up to some particular maximum multipole. And that maximum multipole is 3,000 in temperature, there are more foregrounds in temperature, and 4,000 in polarization. The foregrounds in polarization only start to kick in at higher multipoles. So this is the white noise power spectrum, this is your beam, forward half maximum. I'm going to take, although we have done looking at different configurations, this is the Stroman I'm going to take, f sky of 0.4, 1 minute arc, beam size 1 arc minute, delta t, one arc minute, 1 microkelvin arc minute, delta E, B actually, okay, that doesn't matter. Delta E is 1.4 microkelvins per arc minute. I'm going to include low polarization, low L polarization for Planck using a tau prior. And when necessary, I'm going to pretend that I've included some large scale structure measurements from something like DESI using an H0 prior. In order to show compare like apples to apples as such, I'm not going to use the Planck data when I compare Planck to S4. I'm going to do exactly the same process for the parameters of Planck from the Planck Blue Book, and they roughly chime with what you get from using the real data. So when I compare S4 to Planck, I'm going to do Fisher forecasts, Planck and S4. The forecasts that I do are done using this code called OxFish, which is from the Allison et al. Paper, modified where relevant to include the axion parameters by me and my collaborators. So neutrino mass. Neutrino mass, you can get this target error on the neutrino mass from S4 by using the Lansing deflection power. And so here I'm showing the difference between a power spectrum, a Lansing power spectrum with neutrino mass at 60 milliEV compared to one where it's at zero. And I've got the error bars, the projected error bars, assuming that it's exactly the 0, 1. And then I've got 60 MeV, 120 MeV. So you see that the 60 milliEV can easily be distinguished from zero within the error bars using this measurement. And this is including a tau prior and an H0 prior to break those degeneracies on the amplitude that I was talking about. So you can get about a 4 sigma detection. There's a lot more about the configurations and the dependence on these tau and H0 priors and how they affect this error in the science book. Going on to the axions versus neutrinos. So I said that ultralight axions can suppress structure formation and affect the expansion rate, and neutrinos do the same thing. So you will worry that there are degeneracies between axions and neutrinos. And in the plots on the left, I'm showing this for massive neutrinos and axions. And the plots on the right, I'm showing it for additional relativistic species and axions. So let's go through them one by one. I apologize for the writing being small. I didn't have like internet access for like half the time I was writing this talk because my wireless card was broken. So I was like screen grabbing these things and I couldn't change them properly. Okay, so let's look at this lensing plot. So what I've done here is I've chosen neutrino models and axion models to kind of maximally mimic each other. So in the lensing deflection here, if you take a neutrino mass at the minimum value, so 0.06 eV, that's that brown curve in dotted, I can almost exactly get the same kappa-kappa power with an axion of mass 10 to the minus 30 eV and an energy density of 0.0005. So that's kind of telling you just by comparison what kind of constraints you might get in axions given what we just saw for neutrinos. Neutrino mass of 0.2 eV is mimicked by an axion of 10 to the minus 29 and 0.002 on the energy density, etc. And you really see like very similar effects on the on all of these spectra. And that's just because of this. So you're seeing in this lensing, this suppression of the lensing, is the free streaming of the neutrinos. And in the case of the axions, it's the Compton wavelength being of order the size of the horizon on, at some time scale. On the right-hand side, so I mean, someone comes back to your question about the relativistic species. You see that I really can't mimic the effect of extra relativistic species with axions. So extra relativistic species are the dotted lines, and axions are the solid lines. And I held the fraction of axions fixed. And what I was trying to do, I think, in these cases was both all of these cosmologies require the same H-naught to keep the location of the first acoustic peak fixed. But you see that like really the effects on the observables aren't very similar at all. In fact, they have opposite effects at low L. I mean, CMBS4 isn't gonna do much about that. And these very low mass axions, these are now masses 10 to the minus 32 to 10 to the minus 33 eV. 10 to the minus 33 eV being the Hubble scale today for reference. So these axions are behaving more like dark energy. They're only affecting the expansion rate at very late times, and they're not really affecting the clustering very much. And they're really just very different to delta N effective. So for example, in the kappa-kappa, I mean, these axions have very little effect apart from in the ISW in temperature, in the ISW in EE, and a kind of overall suppression of amplitude in lensing. But it's very different from the neutrinos, which are doing this thing that I said, which gives you the additional free streaming at high L. For the relativistic species, what's our improvement with S4? So we can get about an order 10 improvements on the constraints on effective compared to Planck. And so the plot that I showed you before about this number of relativistic species compared to the freeze-out temperature, S4 at about a 2 sigma exclusion for two different experimental configurations in solid and dashed, can start to hit the level where you would exclude a fermion or a vector that decoupled at any temperature above the top mass. So that's quite interesting. If you really push the experimental configuration, it is possible to get down to constraining the real scale. And here, this is the 2 sigma exclusion. I think the 1 sigma value is still at the level to hit the real scalar. And you can really push that, but it's a little bit in conflict with the science goals for BMO. Oh, so actually, so that's the solid and dashed lines of the two different F skies here. So I've assumed the one, someone in the S4 science book has assumed the one arc minute beam and varied the sky fraction from 0.5 to 0.7, which again is much larger than that Strawman to get these two different lines. It's slightly that in itself is showing you that you've got slightly different science goals for dark radiation compared to tensor modes. So to get tensor modes, you don't really need a big sky fraction. You want to go really deep on a small patch of sky to beat down the foregrounds. But whereas you just need to collect modes to improve your constraints on delta N effective, so you just need a larger sky fraction. Foregrounds aren't really affecting you. That constraint on dark radiation on delta N effective of about 0.027 has some quite interesting consequences for relativistic axions. So to get back to, again, what you were saying, Gazal, So this was pointed out in a nice paper by Bauman, Green, and I'm terrible because I can't remember the third author, Bauman et al. And it's also in the science book. So now, so the axions I talked about before are produced by vacuum realignment. But if your axions are coupled to the standard model, you also get a thermal population. So let's imagine two different possible ways that an axion can couple to the standard model, has to couple to topological densities, because it has a shift symmetry. So you have phi over f to the decay constant, sorry, just phi times some coupling times this topological density for the field strengths. So f could be photons or gluons. And then that coupling, if you're in thermal equilibrium, will give you a population of relativistic axions. And you can work out when it will freeze, and you can work out when it will freeze out. And assuming that you can constrain delta and effective of 0.027, depending on the reheating temperature, you get a constraint on this coupling from CMBS4. So for example, if the reheating temperature was 10 to the 10 GeV, S4 would give you this constraint here on the coupling between axions and photons, which you see is orders of magnitude stronger than what we currently have from helioscopes. And it starts to eat into it's independent of these axions being dark matter, it's a completely different population, but it does actually start to eat into the regime where they could also be dark matter. So you have these two populations, the dark matter one and the relativistic one. And similarly for the gluon coupling, which people kind of have traditionally not thought about as much, you again beat the current constraints by many orders of magnitude. Again, it's based on an assumption about the reheating temperature compared to the freeze-out temperature, but it's pretty interesting, and it's independent of these dark matter searches. It's much more like the constraints from supernova 1987A or the helioscopes, which only depend on the coupling existing. The next thing I want to tell you about, which I'll do very quickly, is about axions and isocurvature. So if axions are around, they're undergoing inflation, they're a spectator field, they pick up some fluctuations, and the these isocurvature fluctuations that they pick up are related to the energy scale of inflation. So if you can measure them, you can constrain the energy scale of inflation just like you can with B modes. And CMBS4 will give us an improvement on the amplitude of those fluctuations by about a factor of 4 compared to Planck. Now, let's put it in context a little bit first. If S4 could measure tensors, B modes, primordial B modes, the rough range of scales for H inflation that gives you access to is between about 10 to the 14 GeV, that's roughly the upper limit of R of 0.1. Because it scales as the square, going down from R of 0.1 to 0.001 to orders of magnitude only gives you a one order of magnitude improvement on H. So if we detected primordial B modes, we've got access to H inflation in this range. But it could just be way lower. Doesn't have to play ball. B modes don't have to be measurably large. With isocurvature, though, you've got a problem. Even if you measure isocurvature, how do you really know that it's axion isocurvature and it's measuring the energy scale of inflation? Well, of course, you have to detect the axions as well. And fortunately, you can do that. You can do axion dark matter direct detection. And so here, I'm saying, let the QCD axion be all of the dark matter. And let me imagine, what range of decay constants can I detect using axion direct detection? And at the same time, what would a measurement of axion isocurvature by S4 tell me? And so the red lines are isocurvature amplitude allowed by Planck, but within the range measurable, detectable at more than 2 sigma by S4, using that factor of 4 improvement. And then the purple bands are the rough ranges of decay constant that are accessible to ADMX, which is actually on dark matter direct detection experiment running now, and CASPER, which is one that has been proposed and that was on the previous slide. So if you did so, okay, so you go and you measure isocurvature and you detect your axions, you then know that's the energy scale of inflation. And that gives you access to a really low set of energy scales of inflation. And so it's a nice kind of synergy between dark matter direct detection and detecting isocharic chimerids in the CMB. And you've got to detect two new things, which is amazing anyway, but by putting those two things together, you get access to energy scales of inflation that are just way, way, way below what you can get with B-modes. In the last part of my talk, I want to tell you about the bit that's very close to my own heart, which is these constraints on ultralight axions and how we can improve that using CMB stage 4. So what I'm showing here are the forecasts on axions, and I've binned them in different masses because I need to use the Fisher matrix, so I need the likelihood to be Gaussian. So the likelihood's Gaussian in each bin, but it's not Gaussian across them. So I just asked for the, this is horrible, U. So I do different forecasts at different masses and ask what the constraint on the energy density is. And the error bars are with and without marginalizing over neutrino mass. So even though I've got those quite strong degeneracies with neutrinos, they can be broken to an extent that the marginalizing over the neutrino mass doesn't significantly degrade my constraints and axions. The fiducial model that I've taken is I've fixed the axion fraction to be 2%, which is consistent with the balancing Planck. And the error bars are kind of assuming a detection scenario, and the solid lines are an exclusion scenario. So the solid lines are what can I exclude at 1 or 2 sigma, assuming 0. And then the error bars are for detection, assuming that 2% is there. And for example, these points here, masses of about 10 to the minus 28 EV, you could get a 13 sigma detection of a 2% departure from cold dark matter. And I think this is a more general message about doing stuff like this, is you're testing cold dark matter at extremely high precision. So, you know, the universe doesn't have to be 100% cold dark matter that clusters in the same way on all scales at all times. This is one such departure from cold dark matter. And over a range of scales, you know, of like 7 to 8 orders of magnitude, you would detect 1% departures from CDM at many, many sigma. And the 95% exclusions are like at the percent level as well. So I think this is really, really cool. The cool thing from a high energy physics perspective as well is that you start to now probe the K constants at the gut scale. So this factor of a few in your 95% upper limit compared to Planck, you know, say, imagine the 95% upper limit from Planck, that's what that U I showed you before, it's the factor of a few in the 95% upper limit, corresponds to an order of magnitude difference in the constraint under the decay constant. Why? So the Planck limits that I showed you before, this is them kind of recast as a scatter plot from a Monte Carlo chain with the colors coded by the initial value of the axion field to get that energy density. The energy density in the axion scales like the square of the initial displacement of the field, which is roughly the decay constant squared, assuming no particular fine tuning on the initial conditions. And so those constraints from Planck, you know, yellow here is about 0.1 of M Planck, which is about 10 to the 17 GeV. That's what I told you before. So you see in this constrained region, it's yellow. Improving the constraint, the 95% upper limit on the energy density by a factor of 3, 5, gives you an order of magnitude improvement on your constraint on F. And so you start to probe the K constants around the gut scale. And that's interesting because, you know, tend to like something between the gut scale and the Planck scale, there's not any real, you know, nothing, there aren't many models where things live there. And the K constants of the gut scale is what comes out in many string theory models for the QCD axion as well. So that's also pretty interesting. In the interest of time, let me skip this slide on degeneracies. And let me tell you about the lower limit on dark matter particle mass. So the other cool thing about these ultralight axions is they're the lightest dark matter candidate I know. I don't know any case where you can have dark matter lighter than this. The rough constraint from Planck, just go back to this guy. You start to say, okay, the dark matter, the dominant component of dark matter, this fraction here goes up to 1 at about 10 to the minus 24 EV, but your constraints really start to degrade at 10 to the minus 25. That is the lower limit on dark matter particle mass from linear physics. It's well understood. I don't know any way you can have dark matter lighter than that. So that's cool. How do we improve that lower limit using CMBS4? And how does it make contact to other constraints on dark matter particle mass? So that's what I'm trying to show in this plot. And we thought long and hard about this plot, me and Renee and Dan. How to show best how you improve the lower limit. So on the left, I'm showing Fisher matrix forecasts for Planck. So we're comparing apples to apples. And on the right, I'm showing S4. The error bar is the 1 sigma error bar. I'm changing the fiducial model for the fraction as well as the fiducial model for the mass. And then the size of the circle gives you the detection significance with which you would detect this model. So I've got tiny for 1, 2, 3, and then big blobs are just greater than or equal to 5 sigma. So on the left, you see for Planck, just what I showed you in that thing before, we've got pretty strong constraints at 10 to the minus 26 EV. 10 to the minus 25 is disfavored. You know, some of these error bars don't reach the bottom. You know, 90% is disfavored at more than 2 sigma. But your constraints really tank out above that. They disappear at 10 to the minus 24. Compare this now to what you get with S4. You could really just exclude, you start to get as strong or stronger constraints that you got at 10 to the minus 26, at 10 to the minus 25. 10 to the minus 26, 10 to the minus 24 is now just as constrained. And 10 to the minus 23, you're starting to rule out 100% of the dark matter at that mass, you know, at the kind of 2 sigma level. And that's very interesting because it makes contact to what we know from the distribution of high redshift galaxies. So these really light guys wipe out structure on scales of order of the Compton wavelength. And if you do that too much, you just don't produce enough high redshift galaxies. So by just counting the number of high redshift galaxies, essentially, you can put a bound, and we know that roughly less than 50% of the dark matter has to be in guys lighter than 10 to the minus 23 EV. But now we're starting to make contact to constraints from galaxies using CMB lensing and S4. The role of lensing is important. So here I'm showing the error on the axion dark matter fraction as a function of the mass with and without lensing. So lensing is the solid lines and dashed is without lensing. So in this really constrained region, an order of magnitude of your constraining power is coming from lensing. But even at these kind of higher masses, 10 to the minus 24, 10 to the minus 23, this is a log scale plot. So a factor of a few, you know, a factor of a few, I mean, that's actually a factor of almost 10 in the mass, is coming from lensing. So that ability to push that boundary by, you know, even a factor of few is coming from lensing. Which brings me on in the last 5 or 10 minutes to the last thing that I want to talk about, which is nonlinear clustering and lensing, which is, I will call, a cautionary tale. So this is based on a paper that I wrote earlier this year, and again, from this forecast paper for S4. Okay, so lensing. Lensing is an integral along the line of sight of the potential. So P is now the power spectrum of the Newtonian potential. This is in the Limber approximation. X is the co-moving distance. And this is the power spectrum of the lensing potential. And the potential is related to the mass distribution by the Poisson equation. So, I mean, this is all small scales, you know, L of a few thousand, small scales, Poisson equation's fine. And on small scales and at late times, the matter is collapsing, undergoing nonlinear collapse into halos. And so we need to take into account of that in that power spectrum for the lensing potential, for the Newtonian potential. And the way that we fudge this, the way that this happens in, you know, all your standard Boltzmann codes to compute the lensing, is in the following way. You take the linear power spectrum for the Newtonian potential, and you multiply it by some ratio that you've computed for the matter power spectrum. And we need to approximate this ratio. But how do we do it? So in CAMB, which is a standard code to do these things that everybody uses, you need to take a formula for this called HaloFit. And this formula is calibrated to n-body simulations of cold dark matter and neutrinos. So if you're going outside of the regime of cold dark matter and neutrinos, you just have alarm bells ringing that you shouldn't be used. You should really check that you can use HaloFit. But why should we check this? When do nonlinearities become important in lensing? Why do we care about them in lensing? And why do we care about them in particular for lensing for S4? So these are just some very rough plots to demonstrate this. So, and again, I had to screen grab these because my wireless wasn't working. So apologies for the small labels, but the screen grab from my own work, I just couldn't get the scripts going. So this label here that you can't see is the difference in the lensing potential power spectrum between a model where I include nonlinearities using HaloFit and a model where I don't for pure cold dark matter. And the nonlinear, and it's the difference in power divided, normalized by the total power. And the scale here on the multipole axis is 10, 100, 1,000. So a multipole of 1,000, you've got about a 10% correction to the power coming from nonlinearities. At a multipole of like 3,000, which is the maximum we're getting from S4, the effect of nonlinearities on the power spectrum is about 50%. So you need to do nonlinear, you need to understand the nonlinear clustering of matter to do lensing with S4. What redshift scales does this come from? So here I'm plotting the redshift kernel of that lensing integral for different multipoles as a function of redshift. And so for multipoles of order 1,000, which we're interested in, the peak that redshift kernel is peaked at redshifts of about 2 to 10. So this tells you that in lensing, we need to care about nonlinear collapse at redshifts of order 2 for multipoles of about 1,000. We need to get those corrections. I'm going to then motivate like a few approximations that I use to try and treat the nonlinear collapse of axions here. Given that I don't have n-body simulations to calibrate to, but I would really like to. But we just want to do forecasts. This is not too important, but it will be important in the real data. So nonlinear collapse happens when the overdensity becomes of order 1. HaloFit makes a decision about this based on the total variance of matter fluctuations. And it says, when the variance of the matter fluctuations on the nonlinear scale is equal to 1, this defines the nonlinear scale, and then you apply the formula. If the fluctuations are linear, you just use the linear power spectrum. Now, ideally, if you've got different components that are clustering in different ways, you want to make that test of where is the nonlinear scale on a component by component basis. If a certain component's fluctuations are linear, its power spectrum shouldn't be corrected, whereas HaloFit is a correction to everything regardless of its nature. And that's because it's calibrated to simulations with just one component. So now I'm going to roughly say, well, when do I have to care about nonlinear clustering for my axions? So here I've computed the variance in the fluctuations just of an axion, assuming that it's subdominant to cold dark matter, consistent with the Planck constraints. At redshift 2, which is the peak of the lensing kernel, for various different masses. So for very light guys, I'm completely linear, completely linear, completely linear. I just about go nonlinear on redshifts relevant to lensing for masses of about 10 to the minus 25 EV. So in my forecast that I showed you, we just decided to say, treat all masses less than 10 to the minus 25 EV as completely linear. Separate them out from the HaloFit calculation, just like the default is for dark energy. So whenever we treat dark energy, it only affects HaloFit via the background, which these guys do. And it affects the lensing through the potential, but the nonlinear correction is only applied to the stuff that is assumed to be collapsed into halos. And CAM does that just like, this is dark energy, this is dark matter. Because these guys change their character as a function of scale, you should really be making a cut that depends on time and mass. But we just made a hard cut and said, basically anything lighter than 10 to the minus 25 EV is just linear, and we can treat it linearly. For the heavier guys, for pushing that boundary on the lower bound of dark matter particle mass, I need to do a little bit better. So I'm going to use something called the Halo model. And so there's a review of the Halo model from 2002, Karain Sheff. And in order to investigate this with the Halo model, I wrote a piece of code called Warm and Fuzzy, which does the Halo model for warm dark matter and fuzzy dark matter, which is what axions are. And that was a modification of a Halo model code by Mead et al., which was used for the CFHT lens survey. And this is what you get for the effect on the matter power spectrum. So I'm going to compare Halo fit to the Halo model. To compare apples to apples, I'm going to make that choice that only if the variance is greater than one do I apply nonlinear corrections at all. Really, this is taken into account by something called the smooth clustering function, but I'm just going to do what HaloFit does and put a hard cut. And so this is this very interesting mass, 10 to the minus 23, where I should expect to be starting to get constraints from CMB lensing, but for which nonlinear clustering is important. So you see, nonlinear clustering is important. The linear power spectrum's here. The nonlinear power spectrum starts to become different from it at redshifts greater than two, sorry, less than two. HaloFit does this totally weird thing, because it's just a fitting function. It doesn't know anything about the physics that's going on here. And it's this totally weird thing, and it puts in loads and loads of extra power right around the nonlinear scale. So obviously, HaloFit is doing something that we're not seeing in the Halo model. The Halo model is physically motivated, and it you know, computes stuff based on physics that you've put in, rather than just a fitting function. So it should describe what's going on much better. Why does this matter? And this really, really matters for lensing forecasts. And it matters because this is what this is the difference between the CDM lensing power spectrum and the lensing power spectrum for axions in three different cases. So the pink case is just when I treat both of them linearly. The dot dashed case is when I treat both of them using the Halo model, but that is not inside CAMB. CAMB does not call a Halo model code, it just uses HaloFit. So when I compute the Halo model power here, I've just done this using the Limber approximation, using a little code that I've got. But then if you use HaloFit, you get a completely different effect of the axions, and that's because of that boost in power that HaloFit gave us around the nonlinear scale, and exactly around the redshift where the lensing kernel peaks. So what we decided to do is, by looking at this, well, in terms of the difference between the spectra, the Halo model gets the sign and magnitude of the effect approximately the same as linear theory. And so for something like a Fisher matrix, where you're only taking derivatives around the model, using linear theory should be okay. So we use linear theory because we think it will describe the derivatives correctly. Because we wanted to use CAMB, but we wanted to inform it by what we know from the Halo model, the two not being completely integrated. Ideally, they should be integrated. And of course, when you're using real data, if you're fitting the data, you need to use the right model. But for forecasts, as long as you've got the sign and the magnitude of the effect okay, you should be okay. Your derivatives should converge. So that is the end of my cautionary tale. And that is the end of everything I want to tell you about S4. And so I will go on to my conclusions. So CMB S4 is a proposed upgrade to existing ground-based telescopes with one possible new telescope in the Northern Hemisphere. If it is funded, it will happen around 2020. So the three main science goals are to get an error on the tensor scalar ratio of 0.001, 0.1%, an error on the neutrino masses of 15 milli electron volts, which would be a 3-4 sigma detection of neutrino mass in cosmology. It'd be really nice to get an error on the effective number of neutrinos, 0.027, then you would rule out anything that decoupled below the top mass. Anything that decoupled above the top mass. If there is nothing else above the top. But you can also do some extra dark matter science. You can look at the degeneracies between neutrinos and other species. I looked at the degeneracies between neutrinos and axions, which affect clustering in a similar way. You can look for new light species and the effect on the couplings of these species. That's this guy here. You can combine isocurvature constraints with dark matter direct detection to learn about inflation. In terms of the pure axion effects, we can detect 1% contributions to dark matter at many sigma, which is a real precision test of cold dark matter. over a big range of scales, which I think is very cool. We got the rough constraints with Planck. This is now getting it really precision. And we can also improve the lower limit on the mass, on the dark matter particle mass by about two orders of magnitude, which is also very cool. These are the lightest things that can possibly be dark matter, and we can improve that limit by a number of orders of magnitude. But we need to understand the nonlinear effect. So developing things like the Halo model, but also developing n-body simulations that are not called dark matter. There's a number of things I've left out that CMBS4 will also do. I have not talked about the dark matter science that you can do with dark matter annihilations, which affects the ionization of the universe. I have not talked about sterile neutrinos, or how you can use the neutrino mass measurements to determine the hierarchy. I haven't talked about dark energy modified gravity, because I don't care. I haven't talked about B-modes, because I don't care. I haven't talked about delensing in foregrounds, because I'm not smart enough. And the last thing that I would like to say, as far as this goes, is that as of these recent, these couple of papers released, you can get involved with all of this yourself, because all of our code is now public. We released Axion CAMB on GitHub, so you can now download our version of CAMB, and you can play with Axions in the CMB yourself. And my Halo model code, Warm and Fuzzy, is also publicly available. So like, I encourage you, if you're interested in any of this, to go to GitHub and fork the code. Thanks. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, so I'm just wondering, does the RFID to the power spectrum require having both cold and hot dark matter, or is it the other way around, in a sense that we're trying to assign some hot and cold candidates to answer sort of the big unknown question of dark matter?
So we only require cold dark matter. If you detect neutrino mass, you would then require hot dark matter. So you can think of the upper limit on the neutrino mass as the upper limit on the amount of hot dark matter there could be. And then similarly with the axion stuff, you can think of the constraint as being a limit on how much fuzzy dark matter there can be. It's not hot, it's not quite hot, but it's similar. But you can also think of that lower limit on the dark matter particle mass in the case of axions as the lower limit on how fuzzy the dark matter can be. And if you interpret, but on the other side for neutrinos, if you said, what if all the dark matter was a sterile neutrino, a single sterile neutrino, how heavy does it have to be? And the answer is the CMB says it has to be heavier than about 100 EV. Lyman Alpha Forest says it has to be heavier than about 1,000 EV. So that's similarly a constraint on how cold is the dark matter. But you can also ask what its component nature is, as in how much is cold, how much is hot, how much is fuzzy, etc. Matt?
So you made the statement that an experiment like stage four can test the nature of CDM to the percent level.
Yeah.
You gave axions an example. What about all the other inventive ways that dark matter theorists have thought to change small scale structure? Do those also lead to a potentially measurable effect? Like, I don't know, this self-interacting dark matter behave in some way like this?
So most of the time when people think of something like, say, self-interacting dark matter or warm dark matter, they're interested in the small-scale problems of CDM, say, like the Chun's papers. And then they make all of the dark matter that. And in that case, the only limit that you get from the CMB is that like upper limit, which in the case of axions, 10 to the minus 23 EV. And it's not as strong as the limits that you get from clusters of galaxies and things, which is what they're interested in. So the models for small-scale stuff aren't generally touched by the CMB. But what I've shown here is in the case of axions, you do start to make contact. You know, the limit from high-Z galaxies is roughly close to what you get from the CMB. But if you allowed, say, a fraction of anything that affects clustering on a scale that the CMB probes, you can constrain the fraction of dark matter that has those interactions. So you could say, let me have a fraction of the dark matter have very strong self-interactions and a fraction be cold. And then you would get a similar U-shaped plot that I got in terms of the coupling, the self-coupling, and the fraction which has that self-coupling. And you would get a similar U-shaped plot. And I would imagine that, I mean, you can basically translate the axion mass into a scale. You could translate the coupling into a scale. and then you would still be getting percent level constraints on the fraction in that species. I think a good way to do that, it's a way that the formalism doesn't fit axions, but it fits a wide variety of other models, is this ethos. This ethos formalism that you might have heard of. So Chris Sigurdsson, Francis Jansier Racine, Jesus Zavala, and a number of other people have come up with this effective theory of structure formation, and has a bunch of different parameters. And that covers all the cases, like, it covers many different self-interacting dark matter, dark radiation models. And then you would get a similar U-shape for that general model. But that general model doesn't cross over to axions. And you could do the same for generalized dark matter of Wayne Hu and all these things. And I think they would all get these sub-percent level constraints over a vast range of scales. If there are no other questions, I want to do a very quick plug for two papers of mine, which I didn't talk about. But if you want to ask me about them over the next couple of days when I'm here, they're coming out this week. One is on black hole formation from axion stars. So we've used numerical relativity to study the collapse of clumps of axions into black holes. And we've plotted a stability diagram, a phase diagram of these guys. And I think that's really cool. And then the other one is an unbiased constraint on axions as a solution to the small scale problems of cold dark matter using dwarf spheroidal stellar velocities. We think it's unbiased. We've done all these mocks and it's better than genes analysis and it's all really awesome. That's the plug. Happy to have more questions about the other stuff though, if there's time.
So another question for your dad? Okay, let's take that again. Thanks.